From the Centre for Public Christianity, you're listening to Life and Faith. I'm Justine Toe. Amy Orr-Ewing is the director of the Oxford Centre for Christian Apologetics. She's addressed audiences from Westminster to the White House, speaking about the truth and beauty of the Christian faith. But her story starts right here in Australia.
You were born here, we understand.
That's right.
But you did leave when you were 2 years old, so I'm going to say welcome home.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. So tell us about the first
Amy was back in Australia as a speaker for our annual Richard Johnson Lecture. And while she was in town, Simon and I couldn't miss the chance to have her on the show. Next week, Amy will be back, this time telling us about her doctoral studies on a remarkable woman who was a contemporary of Tolkien and C.S. Lewis and deserves to be much better known than she is, Dorothy L. Sayers. But this week, we're focusing on Amy's story. And it turns out, in the years that Amy's parents were in Australia, they experienced a couple of life-changing events. Yes, one of them was the birth of their daughter, but they also experienced an unexpected challenge to their faith, or rather, their atheism.
My dad had grown up in a very strongly atheistic home. My grandfather was an East German scientist, an absolutely committed atheist who forbade any talk of God in the home and forbade anyone reading the Bible even. So my father had grown up in a strongly atheistic context with no sort of churchy conditioning. And whilst here in his 30s, happily married to my mum, two fantastic children, great lifestyle, loved the life here. But he began to just ask questions. When I get to the end of my life, when I'm retired and I look back, what will it all have been for? Is this enough? And that sort of question worried him. A colleague at the university took him along to hear a Christian speaking, an apologist actually, speaking about the resurrection of Jesus. And he said that it sort of struck him as quite odd, frankly, but that there was one thing that this guy said that sort of was like a bit of a dagger to the heart, which was the only reason you should be a Christian is because it's true. My dad thought, you know, religion is about superstition, it's about wish fulfillment. Truth and God are opposite categories. It's a category mistake.
Yeah.
But that worried him. And then a few weeks later, he had an extraordinary personal encounter with Jesus Christ. And ended up kneeling on the floor thinking, I need to say something to respond to Christ, to his offer of forgiveness to me. And he thought, I don't know what to say. I have no religious upbringing. And he found himself just saying, Lord, I believe, help my unbelief. Later, he bought a New Testament and found himself reading that in Mark's Gospel, which was slightly surprising.
Coming to Australia for spiritual enlightenment, that's the path that people come on in the tourist brochures. Now, you are also a believer these days. Are you just a believer because your parents were?
That is a great question. I think because my mum and dad were intellectuals and neither of them were kind of conditioned by the church, I had a slightly unusual upbringing in terms of a Christian family, in that they encouraged us to question, to read, and to come to conclusions ourselves, both my sister and I. Growing up in Britain as a Christian, I was always the only churchgoer in my class at school. There was a tremendous amount of peer pressure to disbelieve. And so I think that encouragement from them to own this yourself or not was incredibly important. And for me, that journey of questioning took me to Oxford, to university, to study theology, where every presupposition about the Bible, about God, about faith was challenged
daily
to the nth degree. And it was my experience that the Christian claims and the Bible stood up to that scrutiny. I remember sitting with the dean of my college. I was at Christchurch towards the end of my degree, and him saying, we haven't cured you of your religion, have we, Amy? We've tried everything, but it hasn't worked. But seriously, for me, it has been my experience that if something is true, it stands up to scrutiny and questions are not to be feared, and that the pursuit of truth ultimately for me has led me to Jesus Christ.
Before we get more into that question, can I just rewind you a little bit? And I read that when you were 15, you actually had cancer. And you've talked about how you were the only believer in your disbelieving class. So when you're 15 and get this diagnosis, you know, all the other girls your age are mooning over, you know, rock stars or something like that, but you're grappling with the experience of disease and thinking about God in the midst of all that. What was that like?
I think the strongest memory I have from that time is the contrast from the fear and anxiety that was absolutely overwhelming when the consultant sort of blurted out this diagnosis. I was with my mum in the hospital and it was not done kindly at all. I mean, she was horrified. And the shock of that and the sort of sense of just waves of blackness overwhelming me. And then over the next few days, processing that and actually reading the Psalms, I found to be an extraordinary experience, because here was an opportunity to vocalise what I was feeling: frustration with God, questions, fear, and then to experience actually meeting God, or God meeting me in that place. And I think today, you know, certainly in the context where I am, there's an epidemic of anxiety-related experiences, particularly for young people. And you know, in my life, it was through that the God that I was questioning and had kind of an intellectual path to come to know about him, was this really real, was this substantial, that actually then overlapped and intersected in my own experience, and God met me in the pain and suffering of this world.
And so these days you must draw upon that union of that intellect but also that life experience in order to do your work as an apologist. Now, can you take us through that? Because it sounds like you go around apologising for things, but it's not no. quite like that, is it?
No. It's a slightly unfortunate word, I think, apologist. It comes from the Greek word apologia, which really means to give a reasoned defence. It's what a defence lawyer would stand up and do when you're in court in order to persuade people of your case. So, yeah, apologetics is really about grappling with the intellectual dimensions of the deepest questions about whether God exists, about whether this is fair and just, you know, the way the world is. Does the way the world is cohere with the Christian worldview? But it's not only intellectual, because we as human beings are more than just brains on legs. You know, we think, and obviously that's really important, but life has other dimensions, how we feel, what we experience, the capacity, the possibility of relationship, that desire, that thirst for meaning and purpose and fulfillment. Those different dimensions of human experience, Jesus speaks into all of them. And so for me, any apologetic, any reasonable defence of the Christian faith needs to engage in at those different levels.
Now, despite that clarification of the definition, there are nonetheless plenty of things that Christians ought to feel sorry for or be apologising for. What do you say to people who say, well, yeah, I'm okay with Jesus, but gee, Christians have been rubbish?
You know, I'm right there with you. My friend is a brilliant Christian writer in the UK called Dr. Elaine Storkey. She says, the church recruits from the human race. You know, there's no expectation in the Bible that there's a sort of moral bar that we have to have reached in order to own the name Christian. A Christian is simply someone who's recognised our own brokenness and sinfulness and a need for forgiveness. And therefore, it ought not to surprise us that a lot of the brokenness that is in the world is also in the church. And so I think as the church, we do have a lot of apologising to do for things that have been done in the name of Christ and in the name of the church that do not legitimately represent him.
You're listening to Life and Faith from the Centre for Public Christianity. As an apologist, Amy often finds herself defending the Christian faith. She comes across all sorts of pat dismissals of faith. You know, science disproves God, all religions are the same. How can God be good if there is so much suffering in the world? But as soon as I asked her about the objections to faith that she must come across daily, she was quick to call me out on describing them as pat. She actually takes each objection seriously. She listens, she takes the time and care to engage with every question that comes her way.
I would try and be careful not to ever minimise someone's objection to faith as something pat. I think that most of the articulations against God are actually pretty heartfelt. We live in a culture that's very apathetic about religious things. So when people do articulate, how could there be a God of love and this horrendous abuse has happened to me or my child or my friend? I think that's a real objection that is both intellectual and personal and that deserves the time for us to at least try and respond to. Another question that we find a lot in the West is that whole search for meaning and significance and purpose. Why am I here? And is this enough? Is the material, sort of materialistic life that I'm living, is that all there is to life?
Well, let's talk about one of those. Some people want to talk about the character of God, and they often draw the distinction between this God of the Old Testament, who in some people's minds appears sort of violent and angry and a fearful kind of presence, and then the New Testament, where they say, oh, it's all lovely and kind and merciful. And what's the challenge? You know, the challenge there, of course, is trying to match up those two. Now, of course, the people who wrote about that God of the Old Testament thought he was good. But what? How do you address that quite complex problem?
I think that lots of people have this idea that in order to be loving, God couldn't also hold people accountable or judge evil. But actually, when we dig into that preconception, I think we discover that most of us don't really believe that. Let me give you an example. A few years ago, I lived in the inner city in London. My husband was a pastor there. And I had a very good friend who, at that time, was the same age as me, late 20s. We were very different from very different socioeconomic backgrounds. She had five kids, lived on quite a high floor in a block of flats. She also had about four dogs. You know, none of the dads of her children were still around. In fact, one of them was in prison. He was a crack dealer, very violent man. She had a restraining order against him. And she became a Christian. We became very good friends. We met weekly. And one day, her ex-partner, the father of one of her children, got out of prison and he came to her apartment and broke in and beat her virtually to death. And I'll never forget seeing her. When I saw her, it was just incredibly shocking. She was unrecognisable. Now, in that situation, what did I feel? What did love cause me to feel about the perpetrator of that violence? Love meant that I cried out for justice for her. See, love and justice go together. And when we read the Old Testament, we see a loving God who is also a God who judges evil. That's actually the same as the God we read about in the New Testament. Now, in the Old Testament, one of the means of his judgment within a very limited time period is war. Now, we can say, well, we don't like that idea. And we read it today through our sort of Western eyes and think that doesn't make sense to us. But I think if we understand it within a framework of a loving God who judges evil perpetrators on behalf of the victim, you know, it begins to make a bit more sense.
Amy is not only a prolific speaker, she's a writer as well. One of her recent books is called Why Trust the Bible?
The Bible describes the real world as we know it. It has the ring of truth. This is not a sort of religious, mythical bubble that we need to jump into that only makes sense internally if we just close our minds to the real world that we experience. The Bible is trustworthy because it diagnoses the human condition that you and I experience. It speaks of it in real terms with empathy about the darkness and violence of this world. And it introduces us to the God who's entered this real world in the person of Jesus. So I think we can trust the Bible in those kind of existential terms. But secondly, historically, it is my experience through studying the manuscript tradition, through studying the historical process of the transmission of the Bible, that this stands up to rigorous scrutiny, that the source material for the Bible is vast, that where there are differences between manuscripts, those differences are not covered over in English or other language translations. There's an openness about the process of transmission, and I think that makes it trustworthy.
It's also a book that you've seen has had an impact in some quite surprising places. I've read that you went to Afghanistan when you were 19. You have all these wonderful stories in your biography. And you presented the Bible to someone in that circumstance,
yeah.
Didn't you?
Yes, while I was a theology student at Oxford, I was also not just studying Christian theology, but studying Islamic thought as well. And a small team of us went to Afghanistan. We ended up going the weekend after the BBC had been in town doing their groundbreaking documentary on the Taliban. And we got the opportunity as theological students to interview the education minister, the religion minister, and the foreign minister, and the keeper of the Holy Quran, the religion minister. And in the process of that interview in their military headquarters, we also gave them Bibles saying, you know, we think this is the most precious gift one human being can give another. And, you know, they were all heavily armed. We did wonder what was going to happen next. Let's put it like that. And you could cut the atmosphere with a knife. But the keeper of the Holy Quran, the religion minister, took hold of the Bible and looked at it and he said, I know exactly what this book is. I've been praying to God for years that I could read this book. Thank you for bringing me this book. I'll read it every day. And that just struck me as amazing, that at the heart of one of the most violent regimes the world has known, there was someone who was wanting to read the Bible but had never had the opportunity.
Yeah, that is very surprising. Now, Amy, while we might come to accept that the Bible is trustworthy in the terms, in the way that you've described it, is it relevant? I mean, what does the Bible have to say to a very complex modern society, or even, you know, my own life in that place?
My experience is that the Bible has relevance today because it introduces us to the person of Jesus, who came in history, was God incarnate, made God making himself known to us in human form. And that truth connects with our reality, the reality of our brokenness, of our anxiety, of our pain, of our sin, of our shame, because in Jesus, God deals with the human condition by going to the cross and offering us forgiveness, offering us new life. Now, it's interesting to me that the primary image that Jesus used for what it came means to come to know God is the image of birth. Now, as a mother of twins and another little boy, it strikes me as odd that a single 30-something-year-old ancient Near Eastern male would invoke the image of birth. You know, birth is overwhelmingly, excruciatingly painful. It's a visceral struggle for life over death. You know, there's blood, there's guts, there's gore in the process of birth. And Jesus says, coming to know God is so real that the image I'm going to use to describe this is it's like being born. There was no life, and now there is undeniably this screaming baby, there's life. How much more relevant could things get? God is saying that coming to know him is like being born all over again. This is ontological. This is real. This is visceral. It's undeniable when this has happened.
From the Centre for Public Christianity, you've been listening to Life and Faith with Justine Toe and Simon Smart. Amy Orr Ewing joins us again next week to talk about Dorothy L. Sayers, one of the first women to graduate from Oxford and a force to be reckoned with.
She disliked the idea of arguing for women's equality on the basis of calling women a class. So she's saying, you know, we're not a special class of human, we're actually human.
You won't want to miss the conversation. Sign up for our newsletter at publicchristianity.org or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Just type Life and Faith in the search box to find us. While you're there, please leave us a rating or a review. We want to know what you think of the show, and it helps other people find it as well.